Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, the best of Valley Edition. Some of our favorite segments from the past year or so on our program. We'll hear from author Gerald Haslam as he talks about his new book, Leon Patterson, A California Story. We'll also talk to Fresno-based jazz vocalist Karen Margoth and get an in-studio performance. But first, we go back to June of 2013, when David Moss Masumoto, his wife Marcy, and daughter Nikiko visited our studio to talk about their new book, The Perfect Peach. Without a doubt, one of the best parts of summer in the San Joaquin Valley has to be fresh stone fruit from valley orchards. Ripe, juicy, and delicious, the valley's peaches, plums, apricots, and nectarines are the envy of the rest of the country. And perhaps no one has done more to boost the profile of our local peaches, and in such a poetic way, than our guest today, Delray organic farmer and writer David Moss Masumoto. He's a third-generation family farmer, a James Beard Award finalist, and this year was appointed by President Obama to the National Council on the Arts. He's also a member of the board of the James Irvine Foundation, which, in the interest of disclosure, is a supporter of this station. His 1995 book, Epitaph for a Peach, brought his work to a national audience and received a Julia Child Award. His most recent book, The Perfect Peach, combines both recipes and stories and truly reflects his family farm. As his wife Marcy and daughter Nikiko are co-authors, this lavishly illustrated book gives readers recipes for everything from prosciutto-wrapped peaches to peach galette. They all join us here today in our studio for Valley Edition. Moss, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back.
And Marcy, thank you for joining us. And Nikiko, thanks so much for being here.
Love being here. Thank you.
Always a treat.
Moss, I'll start with you. The title of the book, The Perfect Peach, refers to so many different things. The first thing that came to my mind is there anything more perfect than a peach?
One of the challenges on our farm is that we always want to raise that perfect peach. It becomes a goal that we strive for every year. And it's a fun goal because this is a product of nature. So perfection isn't a static object. It involves sometimes the flavor, sometimes it's the juices. And this year, it involves recipes that Marcy and Nikiko had developed for this cookbook.
While I'm a big fan of peach pie and peach ice cream, for me, I've always thought it's been really hard to improve upon the flavor of the peach that's just picked ripe from the tree. Has that been a challenge to in preparing this book to cook the recipes but avoid eating the peaches before they're actually in the recipe? That would be my challenge, I can tell you that.
There's a great division of labor that occurred in this cookbook. I don't cook well at all. So I handled the essays of the book where Marcy and Nikiko divided up the recipes, the 50 recipes that they came up with.
Part of the story of the perfect peach is in search of what is a perfect peach, and then how do you use that perfect peach in the kitchen? So it's kind of a combination of enjoying that peach that will burst with flavor in your mouth and juices dangle on your chin after the running down your cheeks. But the other part is, what can you do with them other than eating them out of hand?
Nikiko, you're the fourth generation on your farm now.
Yes.
What's your earliest memory of your family's produce, these beautiful peaches?
I don't remember my first peach because I say that I probably had it in the womb. But two of my earliest memories about harvest, when I could identify numbers, I was given the job of stamping our peach boxes. So I must have been 4 years old. And so when we started packing every summer, I would get this purple ink and these really old, worn stamps that we'd used for generations. And my job was to stamp each box. And somehow at the end of the day, I would always end up with this pink and purple ink all over my hands.
You've brought some peaches here with you today. Moss, I want to ask you, every year is different. You mentioned that in the book. What has this year's harvest been like so far? We're at the beginning of the season, but some varieties are already out there and already almost done.
It's been an early year because we've had a very, if you remember, in April, it was very warm. It felt like summer. And we also, of course, had a very, very dry year. So those elements caused the ripening to mature. We're probably about a week ahead of last year, which meant it's like I lost the week of work sometime in the month of May. It just disappeared. So we're frantically sprinting right now. But because of the warmth, I think the quality is just amazingly juicy this year. And so I'm finding the quality very, very good. Some fruit, one variety, the fruit was a little small this year. So we're trying to understand the dynamics of how to work with small fruit in the marketplace. The marketplace tends to reward big ones, and we tend to have small ones. So we're trying to, again, redefine that notion of what is perfection. And a perfect peach isn't always the biggest one or the reddest one. It's the one that we think we have has flavor. And that's what we want to do and instill that sense of memory with people when they eat their peaches.
You've been farming in an organic method for decades now. Tell us about why you made that decision and how has that changed over the years as organic has become such a big buzzword. But it's really more than just that word in your philosophy and approach.
Yeah, I began farming organically for a couple reasons. One was when I first came back to the farm, I was trying to figure out how can you survive as a small farmer. And when we sold into the conventional marketplace, we were just such a small player that we were just overwhelmed. And everything was based on production. And we didn't have that big of a farm. We have an 80-acre farm, and 25 acres are in peaches and nectarines. So how could we compete? So one method, one thought, one approach was if we farmed organically, it would be a way for us to differentiate our product. The other one, of course, was I did my undergraduate work at Berkeley. So I ran away from the farm, kind of got radical, but then came back to the farm too. When I came back, I think I did bring some ideas and attitudes. And one was definitely to look at the land that we worked in through the lens of the environment and the ecology. And organic farming for me fit what we wanted to do on the farm because it was all about promoting life. And that life would then overlap. So when I got married, we had children, that was all part of the life of the farm. And organic farming for me is all about sustaining and promoting life.
I'd like to throw in there that as wife and mother, as we were contemplating what directions we were going to go with the farm, we had a young child. We live on the farm. We live 20 yards from our vineyards and our orchards. And the requirements for conventional farming are that you post signs, you know, with the crossbones when you've applied pesticides. And I'm thinking, how can I tell my 18-month-old toddler to stay out of the front yard because there have been chemicals applied? So to me, it just made sense, especially living in the environment, living on the farm, that we care for that environment and care for all of the life on the farm.
That 18-month-old toddler has since grown up and she's with us today. Talk about what it's been like to work, obviously, on the farm together as a family and now on this book together as a family.
Yeah.
Why don't you start, Nikiko?
Yeah, I grew up working. And to be honest, I really didn't know how special it was until I left. It was when I, too, following my dad, went to UC Berkeley, and I took an environmental studies class that I was able to put our farm in a larger context, in a global context, in a political context, and really understand the importance and the radical choice to farm organically. And since then, since I have grown, and I can say I'm an adult now, and we worked on this book together, I really felt really lucky. I felt I got to emerge as a peer with my parents through collaborating on this book, and I felt that was a very special experience to work as equals.
It's really tricky to work on a family farm because you're living together and you're working together and you're making decisions that are also for the long term too. So you try to combine all these together and you quickly realize if this is going to work or not. And so far it's working, and I think it will continue to work too. It brings out and amplifies all the dynamics in a relationship for good and bad at the same time. And even working on this cookbook, it was very clear early on that I would have nothing to do with the recipes. And it was fascinating to watch Nikiko and Marcy develop recipes and work together as a mother and a daughter, and also as peers too.
It was a real pleasure to work with Nikiko, because of course she learned to cook with me from early on, and so, you know, I went from the teacher to the peer in a sense, and it was a joy to learn how the difference in styles that each of us had, what we brought to the kitchen, basically. And it's probably defined by our generation, by our age, by our era, kind of enlightenment, and what influenced us more. So what I brought to the cookbook the majority of the time were the dessert recipes, the traditional, the pies, the cobblers, the crisps. As well as the section on most of the section on preserving food, because that was something that was really important to me, and I fear the loss of that skill to keep good fruit to enjoy year round. And Nikiko brought a completely different perspective, a new, fresh California cuisine style of cooking, I believe.
Well, I didn't have the depth and wealth of knowledge that my mom had, so I had to really have a wild approach, at least wild for me. And so I did a lot of thinking and imagining the wildest combinations I could possibly come up with. And some of the results were things like peach gazpacho. That recipe, I literally went into our kitchen with a huge basket of vegetables and just locked myself in there until I came up with something. One of the recipes from that day didn't work, but the peach gazpacho, I love it. I think it did. So I think maybe in a way our age difference really was is a strength, because my newness meant I had to innovate.
If you just joined us today on Valley Edition, our guests are the Masumoto family, the authors of the new cookbook called The Perfect Peach. It's really more than just a cookbook, though. It has recipes and stories from the Masumoto family farm, Marcy, Nikiko, and David Moss Masumoto. I've noticed in the book, Moss, that there's many references to peaches in human terms, as if the peaches and the varieties are people. And I'm wondering, what is it about the peach, and these peaches in particular, that inspires that connection?
Well, I think one thing we forget that food is alive. I mean, especially peaches. It comes from something that's alive. It's not a commodity, and it's not a product. So once you start thinking of it in that different frame, you develop a relationship with it. And especially as a farmer and a family farmer, we develop relationships with our peaches. We get to know how they grow, what weather they like, the dirt that they like, and we develop those kind of personal relationships, and that's exactly what we want. We want to personalize our produce because we commit our passion to it, and we hope that that passion is expressed through flavor and the juices and the nectar and the aroma of our peaches. So the idea of personifying it is to bring and put life back into food, and not only as a peach, but also Marcy and Nikiko with their recipes, they wanted to put that life back into a recipe. So that's why all the recipes have pretty extensive head notes, as they call it. And a head note is that beginning paragraph to a recipe. It tells the backstory. In a way, it's a very short story that has to capture all the meaning of the recipe in about maybe 70 words. It's actually, as a writer, I looked at that and I go, I would have a tough time writing a head note, because I'd want to start expanding it. Maybe it'd be like 4 pages of a head note before you got to the recipe. So it was a real challenge watching them and witnessing them as they wanted to put their own personality into that recipe and express it as this little literary gem of a short story to begin each recipe.
Nikiko, eating a peach is an amazing experience. Some would say a sensual experience. The flesh, the aroma, the juice from the peach. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that relationship between the human experience and the peach.
Yeah, when I think about eating a peach fresh off the tree, what's interesting is I think about my own individual body. But when I think about cooking, I think about a communal experience. And I think that the communal experience is actually always there, even if we're eating an individual peach by ourselves. But there's something so magical and something I believe that's so sacred about both farming and cooking, because we are preparing something that is going to enter someone else's body. It's going to nourish their body. I mean, it's a very intimate experience. And I just love, I show my love for people by cooking for them. And I show my love for the earth by farming. And it has given me so much as a young person, as a young farmer.
One of the elements too about working with food, and we work with it day and night. It's out in the fields, but yet it's in our house, it's on our tables. It's all about that human element, and you're absolutely right in framing it as part of this humanity that we live. And that humanity extends also to like how we want to hopefully treat our workers and what we do with the extra peaches that we have, because we donate them to a couple like Heinz Hospice gets a lot of our peaches just to give away, because it's part of that other gift economy that's part of the work that we do too. And it's all part of that almost sacredness that we have with our fruits.
Marcy Nikiko and David Moss Masumoto are our guests. I'd like to ask all three of you to read some passages, because this is more than just a traditional cookbook. There's some great stories, and anyone who's a fan of the three of you will definitely enjoy the prose in this book as well. Moss, let's start with you, and what selection do you have for us today?
I'm going to read a short passage from an essay called Sweat. And the reason why I wrote this and put it in the cookbook is I wanted people to know that when they're eating a wonderful peach, making a recipe with a peach, they understood the sweat and the work that's involved with it. So here's this section about sweat. I'm not sure you understand sweat. Out on the farm, I've tasted sweat, a salty, tangy flavor as it drips down my temples, beads on my upper lip, and slips across my cheeks. Farm work makes me sweat. It first appears on my chest, seeping through my pores, subtle and silent, unannounced, on bare skin. Sweat defines the character of our farm. I think of sweat as clean and honest. Sweat reminds me of limits. Summer work in 100-degree heat, hellishly hot. The work beats me. I take short breaths, saving energy, feeling my heart race, the veins and arteries pulsating. I want to quit. Not worth it. Sweating is cutting years off my life, a drip off my chin, my nose, draining life away. Sacrifice years for a peach harvest. The work beats me again and again. Start out young. After a few years of sweat, you suddenly discover you're old. I stagger home and collapse. My children see me. They worry. Something wrong, Dad? Are you okay? They ask. My eyes stay shut. I shake my head. This farm's gonna kill me. They stand silently. They know I'm telling the truth. Sweat and peaches.
David Moss Masumoto reading from his new book, The Perfect Peach, a piece titled Sweat. Moss, these peaches, they are really a part of you and a part of your family. What's it like seeing them go across the country to some of the finest restaurants in the world and right here at home? It's a little part of you, isn't
it? Exactly. And there's a sense of satisfaction, of contentment, of relief to be able to share what we do and hopefully find homes for all these peaches and all this fruit. And at the same time, make that connection and dissolve that division between rural and urban, city and country, and have that food be the thing that that connective tissue between people, so that they understand that food doesn't just come from a grocery store. It comes from people working the land, and add that human element to the foods that we eat.
It's not just preserving peaches for the season. It's also preserving these varieties, some of which are becoming quite rare. Talk a little about that.
One of the challenges we faced was that I wanted great tasting peaches. The whole industry went through a metamorphosis where they began to grow peaches that looked good, were bigger, were redder, and had shelf life. Older varieties lacked those qualities, and they were suddenly gone. All of our varieties tend to have a lot of fuzz because that's part of that old tradition. When they bred away some of those things, I think they accidentally bred away flavor. So what we set out on a crusade was to keep these things, to keep this flavor, to keep this memory alive in people. And we're so very fortunate that the timing worked as the organic marketplace started to expand, as, you know, the local market, the idea of local mentalities, the culture of food started to expand. We were right there, and our peaches and our farm fit that.
One of the things that Nikiko and I tried to illustrate in the book is there's a section called the Peach Primer, and we purposefully included explanations to the peach lover, to the cook, to the reader, as to how do you select a peach? What is a good peach? What's the difference between a yellow flesh peach and a white flesh peach? How do you store them? How do you use them? How do you know when they're ripe? What, you know, do you want a really soft peach for a certain dish or a firmer peach? And so part of this book is also trying to educate our readers all about peaches that I think many people have lost. I mean, generations ago, when we had access to our aunt and uncle or our grandparents that lived on a farm, people had the understanding of the seasonality of food and the qualities of food. And today, I think many of our consumers don't have that opportunity. So we're trying to share that knowledge, that history, that experience through our book with our readers.
Nikiko, speaking of generations, you're the fourth generation on this family farm. You're the Generation Y representative here. Food culture has become such a big thing, a big trend beyond just the food world. It's become a part of popular culture, and younger people are exploring food in different ways. You have publications like Modern Farmer magazine that are out now and so many different things. Talk about what something like this, what your farm means, not just to you, but to your generation, and the idea of sustainable produce, organic produce, and putting something like flavor over size and color and all of the things that we traditionally have marketed at us in the supermarket. What does that mean to you as a member of your generation?
Yeah, I think that right now there's a resurgence, there's a revival going on in young people, with young people and young communities about food and farming. And you see a lot of young people wanting to resuscitate that connection directly with the land. And I'm really invigorated by that. At the same time, I think one of the goals of our book is to tell a whole story of farming, not just the romantic rock star farmer side of farming, but the real side of farming, the farming that involves questions about uncertainty. How can we do this? Questions about hard work, questions about how to live and work with family. And that's one of my hopes, is that within the young people movement and our renewed sense of attention to food, that we're not just cherry picking the privilege story, the story of the fine dining, but we're also really understanding the policy implications, the implications for the environment and our own sustainability on the ground as people.
It's a delicious part of summer, and it wouldn't be complete without peaches and stone fruit from the Masumoto family farm. Joining us in our studio today, our guests have been Marcy, Nikiko, and David Moss Masumoto, authors of the new book, The Perfect Peach, Recipes and Stories from the Masumoto family farm. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. We'll be back in just a moment.
Luck could be a lady tonight.
Hey, Skeets, you hear about this FM89 drawing for 10 G's? Only 60 clams. Take some of that dough you earn at the candy store and get on it.
You dig?
Tickets are now available for Valley Public Radio's $10,000 drawing. Your $60 ticket purchase gives you a chance to win $10,000. Call for tickets at 800-275-0764.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Gerald Haslam is something of a Renaissance man. A historian, novelist, essayist, and biographer, he is one of California's most respected writers and has devoted much of his career to telling stories about life in the Central Valley. His writing is much like the region he comes from, direct, unpretentious, and often filled with surprising depth and color. The Oildale native's newest book, Leon Patterson, A California Story, is co-authored with his wife Janice and tells the story of a young man from Taft who became one of the nation's top high school and collegiate athletes, only to have his life cut short by a terrible illness. In the process, Haslam gives us new insights into life in Kern County in the post-war years. Gerald Haslam joins us now on Valley Edition. Gerald, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And I should add that Gerald joins us this morning, July 1st, on his 53rd wedding anniversary. Congratulations to you.
Oh, thank you even more for that.
Tell me about working on a book with your wife, both this new biography and your previous book on S.I. Hayakawa. You both shared a byline. What was that experience like?
Well, Jan has actually been important in all of my books. She does all the editing. She does the bibliography. She does the index. And she does some of the rewriting. So she should have had her name on the other 20-plus books, but I had to talk her into it. And she felt as though we didn't need two names on the covers. We work together very well. It's kind of interesting. I think it's pretty serendipitous how well you get along with people. We get along quite well.
That's definitely sounds like a great team. Turning to this book now, on the surface, Leon Patterson might seem like an unlikely candidate for a biography. He had a tragically short life, but he's not a household name. How did you come across his story, and what drew you to share it with readers?
Well, I was a young high school athlete when Leon was. I was 3 years behind him, but I competed in some of the same track meets he did, and he was an absolute hero to those of us in the South Valley, at least. When he died, I was a high school journalist and still a high school athlete, and I found it almost unbelievable because this young man who seemed to be the apotheosis of athleticism was gone, and to most of us it seemed quite suddenly. And only much later did I realize that he had been diagnosed as terminally ill 3 years before his death, and had known he was going to die very young while he was accomplishing wonderful athletic feats. And the whole question of how does a young person, someone who's 17, 18, 19 years old, deal with that knowledge haunted me. And so I just felt as though I needed to. This is one of the books I had to write before I died, and so I've done it.
It's truly an amazing story. Much of Leon's story, though, has to do with his family and his upbringing, and it's a story that's not unique to him. Many in the South Valley and throughout California can share a similar story about how they came to the Golden State. Tell us about his family and what shaped him in his very early years.
Right. He was a migrant from Arkansas. His family had a small farm there that simply had gone belly up. It could not cope with the Depression economy. And so they had made their way west, as one of the brothers said to me, a day at a time. It took them almost three and four years to get to California. Desperate for work, the little kids had gone to work. Leon had started at the age of six working in the fields doing piece work. And they just hung on, basically, until the father finally found a job in the oil fields near Taft that had steady pay, that had retirement benefits. One thing and another. Unfortunately, the father was a drinker, and they never seemed to be able to get ahead economically, although by settling in the area around Taft, it allowed Leon for the first time to become a part of a settled society, and at that point he became a fairly good student and a wonderful athlete.
There's also a love interest in this story, and that's Dixie Kenny. Tell me about her and how she changed Leon's life.
I think it was absolutely serendipitous that Leon would encounter a girl like Dixie Kenny, who came from a settled family with real values, that they pursued. She was an attractive, dark-haired girl, one of the beauties at Taft High School, also perhaps the top female athlete at Taft High School. And Leon began dating her when she was a freshman in high school. And they dated throughout her high school 4 years. Her family made him part of itself. So he had a group of people who offered him consistent social support at a time when poor kids could, in the Valley in particular, poor kids with Southern drawls could be discriminated against.
Yes, yes, indeed. There was also a coach that played a big role in Leon's life. Tell me about Tom O'Brien.
Tom O'Brien was another miracle in Leon's life. He was, aside from being perhaps the best technical coach for a shot putter, discus thrower, or any place in the state for an interscholastic thrower, he was, again, a man of real values. He was a practicing Catholic who had a family of his own, and he welcomed Leon into his family, fed him. He could see he spent nights there. And he made himself available to Leon for the kinds of talks you hope you can have with your parents, but that Leon seemed to have trouble having with his. So that, to a very real extent, Leon was adopted by Tom O'Brien and his family.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with author Gerald Haslam. His new book with his wife Janice is titled Leon Patterson, A California Story. It tells the story of a young man from Taft, California. Actually, I guess you could say from Derby Acres, California,
right,
if we really want to get specific here. And his rise as one of the top high school and collegiate athletes in America in the 1950s, only to have his life cut short at the age of just 22, leaving behind a young wife and a son. This is subtitled A California Story, and that's one of the things that really caught my attention. You really do more than just tell us Leon's personal story. You're also writing about Kern County and California in the 1950s, the years after the war, the years after the Great Migration, in the years following the Dust Bowl. This is as much about Kern County and Taft and places like that as it is about Leon, is it not?
It was intended to be. Everything happens in a context, and the context will shape how things happen. California was undergoing tremendous change at that time. The whole post-World War II crush was on, and you look, for example, at the San Joaquin Valley, just basically just from Fresno south, and athletics spiked a sudden, remarkable spike of world-class athletes emerged. Many of them were from families that had come from the South, the Mid-South, the Southwest, where there had been no opportunity for frivolities like sports or even frivolities like education in the view of some of the parents. And the Valley benefited tremendously from those kinds of people. And we think now about people like Rafer Johnson or Lemon King or Lon Spurrier, these wonderful world-class athletes who were very often the first members of their families to graduate from high school. So the Valley was changed, and they changed these young people who came as well. Our society is much richer, as far as I'm concerned, as a result of that migration.
You talked about the shock as a high school journalist learning of Leon's death. He was this superstar in Kern County back in the 1950s, went to USC, was probably going to be on the Olympic team, was an amazing shot put and a discus athlete in track and field. And these are the days when track and field was a very big deal.
It was a big sport.
Tell us about a little more about that shock and what that was like and what he meant to Kern County in those days.
Well, I think Kern County was pretty parochial. It was pretty much an isolated place run by old families. And the value systems were old value systems that meant to perpetuate the power structure that had been there. When this migration occurred, it began to shake up the roots of those values. People had to look at a more multiracial kind of society. They had to look at a more multi-sectional kind of society. They had to understand that people who just happened to speak with a different twang were not inferior. And it enriched, in that sense, the perceptions of people in my generation. We were the first generation where you would see at the back of a team bus coming back from a track meet or a football game, the black kids and the white kids sitting together. That had never happened before. And that began to shape what was going to happen two decades hence. It was the first time when large numbers of Latinos got involved in intercollegiate and interscholastic sports, and that began to shape the society. I think it was churning. We didn't understand, those of us who were kids then, did not understand, I think, the unexpected consequences of our own social actions, but they have changed the place, I think, very much for the better.
It's an amazing book, and it's available now. Again, it's called Leon Patterson, A California Story. Its author, Gerald Haslam, joins us on the phone today. His wife of 53 years, they're celebrating their anniversary today, in fact, is a co-author of the book. It tells the story of a young athlete from Taft High School in the 1950s who went on to become one of the nation's most gifted high school and collegiate athletes, only to die with a tragic illness at the age of 22, accomplishing these great feats, knowing he had this disease. The story also paints a picture of life in Kern County in the 1950s. The book is available on Devil Mountain Books. Gerald Haslam, thank you so much for joining us today on Valley Edition.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore. When people talk about international jazz stars, they don't normally talk about Fresno. But one Fresno musician is quickly gaining a reputation not only in Central California, but nationwide and beyond. She joins us now in the studio. Her name is Karen Margath. Karen, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
Karen is a local vocalist and has released a new CD called Away With Words, The Songs of Carol Coates. And Karen, this is a real California-centric CD in that you have folks from all over the state, including a number of musicians with Fresno ties,
absolutely,
appearing on this album. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how this came about.
Well, I had met Carol Coates. He lives in Carmel on the coast of California. And I was over at his home one day and he sat down at the piano and started playing some of his tunes. And I didn't realize what a songbook he had until that moment. And I just had the idea of doing an album of his tunes. And then, you know, back home in Fresno, it was a matter of gathering up musicians. And I just wanted, the best that I could get. So you don't have to look much farther than the Central Valley to find some really outstanding musicians. So I just pulled from there's a different group on each song for the most part. We sort of mixed and matched the group according to the tune to sort of make it sound just right, and pulled from Gilbert Castellanos, who is a Fresno native but who lives in San Diego now. Pulled from him. He came up and
he's a great trumpet player.
Oh, fantastic trumpet player. I'm just so honored to have him join us on the album. And then Richie Cole, who's from L.A., a great legendary saxophonist, he joined us on several tunes. And a trombonist came down from Sacramento by the name of Bob Williams. I mean, Jason Warner from San Diego came up and played piano and also did the arranging. So, yeah, just a great group.
Tell me some more about Carol Coates. He's a very interesting songwriter. He writes both the music and the words, as mm-hmm. I understand it. And he's worked with some of the biggest
yes.
names. In fact, he's written songs for some of the biggest names.
Yes. He's a wonderful sort of Randy Britt. He's in his 80s. He's 83. He's fabulous. And he was discovered at the age of 21 by Sinatra. He was living in London and, you know, schlepping his tunes around, trying to shop them around to singers to get them to do his tunes. And Sinatra was there in London to do a concert, and he asked, hey, is there anybody in town who has a song about London? He wanted a song about London. And so he heard through the local people there about this guy, Carol Coates, who had a song called London by Night. And he called Carol in, and they became fast friends, and Sinatra did the tune. He recorded it, two or three different versions of it over the years, and that launched Carol's career at the age of 21. Sinatra called him the kid and brought him over to the States and did a number of his songs, and then that sort of got him going, you know, and he wrote songs for all sorts of sort of famous vocalists of the day, so...
Now, Karen has her band here, and we're going to get to them in just a moment. But this is very exciting to have live music in our studio today, so we're looking forward to this. Tell us a little more about your career, Karen. You're someone who a few years ago sort of burst on the stage beyond Fresno with your last CD that got some amazing write-ups in Jazz Times and Downbeat Magazine, 4.5 stars out of 5, which is usually reserved for stars like Diana Krall and company. In fact, I think you might have actually beat her out in a few of the ratings.
That was an amazing thing. And I call it polite persistence because I had really no budget for that CD. I recorded it in like a day and a half, again, with local Fresno musicians, great musicians. And then I, you know, ordered 1,000 copies of the CD because that's the best rate if you order 1,000. So there, then I had like this closet filled with CDs, and you know, every month or month and a half, I would just package up a bunch of them and send them out to jazz publications and jazz festivals, and I would send them over and over again to the same, you know, places, and just figured if I'm polite and persistent, I'd follow up with emails, you know, phone calls. I was just sort of bold about it, you know, and then the Jazz Magazine in France did a lovely review of it out of the blue, and then just more reviews started coming in, and I think, I feel like the music industry has opened up for the independent artists out there in the sense that if you are, you know, good, and first of all, you have to be good, and then I think if you are, you know, sort of persistent and polite and human, and you talk to people, you know, on a human level and you know, ask politely if they might listen to your CD, I think eventually, you know, you'll get heard. And I think that's what happened.
What was it like being a Fresno musician? And I think even in reading some of the reviews of your CD, people were like,
yeah,
this woman is from Fresno? I didn't know that they had musicians in Fresno. But really, the Valley musicians are quite talented. What was that like?
Yeah. You know, it was a real sense of sort of like neener in a way. Sort of like a sense of pride, I guess. You know, like hey, there's almost 1 million people that live in this region. Why wouldn't there be outstanding musicians? And, you know, jazz or good music or good art of any type isn't geographically bound. Like, why would it only come from one place? Why wouldn't it come from here? And so it was sort of like, well, duh, yeah, of course there's great music here.
Now, Karen, you are certainly a professional musician, but that's not your day job.
No.
Tell us a little more about what you do and how this came to be a part of your life briefly before we go to the band.
26 years I've been in public education, and I was a classroom teacher. Mostly grades 4 through 8, and now I work with teachers. I'm what's called an instructional support coach, working mostly with new teachers, but also with arts teachers to try to, just build teacher capacity and help good people stay in the profession, you know, because it can be a tough profession. So, but fortunately, it's a job that allows me my weekends and my summers to develop my other passion, which is music.
Tell us about your band. Who did you bring with us today?
Well, I brought my friends Robert Ruffner on trombone this morning, and I've got Rick Canfield on drum.
Singular. Snail with brushes.
Singular, yes. Perfect. And then on piano, Mr. Daryl DeVores.
Well, it's exciting. So I'll go ahead and let you get set up again. We're talking with Karen Margath. Her new CD is called Away With Words. Karen Margath sings the songs of Carol Coates, a legendary songwriter who lives in the Central Coast. And this new CD is out. It's available online on Karen's website. We'll find out more about that in just a moment. And Karen, you have a number for us.
You know I'm crazy, just crazy for you. You know I'm crazy, it's true. If I was someone else's sweetheart, I wouldn't be so blue today. If I was someone else's sweetheart, they wouldn't bring me down this way. They wouldn't keep me dangling like a puppet on a string. I wouldn't have to sit
home night after night, waiting for the phone to ring. If I was someone else's honey, I wouldn't be in such a mess. You got me in a spin, but still I must confess. Though I might find another who'd be twice as kind and true. If I was someone else's sweetheart, I know I'd still be sweet on you.
Karen Margath in our studio performing live on Valley Edition today. Someone Else's Sweetheart, a tune from her new CD, Away With Words. Karen Margath sings the songs of Carol Coates. We have time for one more tune. What do you have for us?
Yeah, this is a Latin tune, another recent composition of Carol's. He's in his 80s, but he's still writing. And this is a tune he wrote called I Have a Feeling, and then I wrote it, did some Spanish lyrics for it. So I'll do it first in the English, and then I'll do it in the Spanish. So,
great. Karen Margath on Valley Edition.
Okay. 1, 2, 1.
I have a feeling deep down inside we have some feelings that we'd sooner hide. But there's no concealing, things just aren't the same. And I have a feeling we know who's to blame. Where there's true caring, it's wisely been said, there's much more to sharing than just sharing a bed. So I have a feeling it's time to get real. Quit this pretending that it's no big deal, and start revealing again the way that I truly feel. Hay sentimientos dentro de mí. Hay sentimientos escondidos aquí.
No puede ocultar y no puedo mentir. Hay sentimientos, no se puede fingir. Se ha dicho sabiamente, amar físicamente es solo una parte del amor verdadero. Hay sentimientos dentro de mí. Ambos sabemos que esto es amor, el verdadero amor, el que queremos sentir.
Jazz vocalist Karen Margoth and her band joining us today. Her new CD is called Away With Words. We heard Daryl DeVore's piano, Rick Canfield drums, and Robert Ruffner trombone. Karen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Well, that does it for today's Best of Valley Edition. We hope you enjoyed these highlights from our favorite segments of the past. You can find this program and others on our website at kvpr.org. And you can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or tweet us at kvpr. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, reporter Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.